From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we learn about pancreatic cancer and its impact on Wisconsinites. Although relatively rare, the cancer is deadly.
Pancreas cancer is especially important in Wisconsin because right now, pancreatic cancer in Wisconsin is the second leading cause of adult cancer death, behind only lung cancer. In the United States, it currently is the fourth leading cause of adult cancer death.
Then Fit for You visits a new wellness center in New Berlin that caters to older adults. And Milwaukee area novelist Nick Petrie continues to be pleasantly surprised by the success of his Peter Ash novels.
I never thought the first book would see the light of day. And here I am. I'm revising the fifth book. I've got plans for six and seven. Life is strange and wonderful.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. After Jeopardy! Host Alice Trebek announced he had stage 4 pancreatic cancer, many took the diagnosis as a death sentence. The American Cancer Society estimates that just 3% of patients with pancreatic cancer at that stage will survive beyond 5 years after diagnosis. So it was surprising when the 78-year-old Trebek announced he was making a recovery and was near remission. According to our next guest, Dr. Douglas Evans, this is part of a pattern of increasingly effective treatments for the deadly cancer. Dr. Evans is the chair of the Department of Surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he's an expert on pancreatic cancer. He spoke with Lake Effect's Troy Powers and began by answering a simple but common question. What exactly does the pancreas do?
The pancreas has two main functions. It's an organ that sits in the back of the abdomen. It's in a very complicated part of the human anatomy, nestled in the back of the upper abdomen. Behind the stomach, it's intimately attached with the intestine and the bile duct and the liver. So the pancreas has two main functions. Number one, it makes digestive enzymes, which help you digest your food. So in response to eating food, the pancreas is stimulated to secrete digestive enzymes into the pancreatic duct and then out into the duodenum, or the first part of the small intestine. The second function of the pancreas is as an endocrine organ. It makes a number of hormones, the most common being insulin. But you certainly can live without a pancreas. It's just that you would require insulin to maintain a normal blood sugar.
Yeah, so it seems like pancreas issues are somewhat common, actually. And maybe that plays into this. It seems when people first develop pancreatic cancer, there aren't a lot of symptoms.
That's true. Pancreas cancer is especially important in Wisconsin because right now, pancreatic cancer in Wisconsin is the second leading cause of adult cancer death, behind only lung cancer. In the United States, it currently is the fourth leading cause of adult cancer death, about to overtake breast cancer as number three. But in Wisconsin, pancreatic cancer is particularly common, and we do not have a blood test for early diagnosis. So if anyone listening is familiar with prostate cancer, most men routinely get a PSA, prostate-specific antigen test, as part of their routine physical exam. Oftentimes, in patients with colon and rectal cancer, their doctor will check a carcinoembryonic antigen, or a CEA. For pancreas cancer, we don't have a blood test. And the incidence is relatively low. For every million population, the incidence of pancreas cancer is only about 150 people. So the likelihood of getting pancreas cancer is relatively low. The problem is that while our treatments have become incredibly more effective and successful, especially over the past decade, the mortality from this disease is still relatively high. And the symptoms can be very, very subtle in many cases. Only 150 will be affected by the disease, and perhaps only 25% of them will get jaundiced or yellow. So the other 75% of the 150 will just have indolent symptoms of not feeling well, maybe a little upper abdominal discomfort, a little indigestion, just not the energy that they would expect. But still, you know, out of the myriad of people who may complain of a little dyspeptic symptom or a little indigestion or a little upper abdominal discomfort, it will be a tiny, tiny minority that will actually have a pancreatic cancer. So you can see that the challenge for doctors. I mean, we have to be good stewards of medical technology, and it's very difficult to simply say, I'm going to do a CT scan or an MRI on everyone. Probably the single most sensitive symptom and sign right now is in older adults, if the blood sugar goes up, their body weight usually is in parallel with that. In other words, as people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s begin to have a problem with an elevation in blood sugar, it usually is because they're eating a little too much and their weight is going up. If the blood sugar goes up and the weight goes down, that is a fairly common sign of pancreas cancer and one that would warrant imaging with a CT scan or an MRI.
Although it is relatively rare, as you mentioned, pancreatic cancer is responsible for a disproportionate number of cancer deaths. What makes this cancer so deadly? Is it just that it's not very detectable, or is it a more aggressive cancer?
Well, it does spread to other parts of the body fairly early. And right now, with respect to our ability to cure the disease, this is somewhat similar to many other solid tumors, such as certainly tumors of the liver, stomach, esophagus. Once the cancer has spread outside of the primary organ, so in this case, once the pancreas cancer has spread to another part of the body, even though our ability to treat the patient has become vastly improved over 5 and 10 years ago, the patient in most cases will not be cured. So that the overall cure rate is relatively low, since perhaps 30 to 35% of patients present initially with a pancreas cancer that is operable and has not spread to other parts of the body. And then secondly, pancreas cancer can cause the death of a patient with a much lower tumor burden than occurs with, for example, breast cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer. Many patients, and oftentimes patients' families, will say, well, how will I die? How will the cancer cause my death? And even though we've done incredible amounts of research in this area, we actually don't have the answer to that simple question. But basically, cancers convert the normal ability of the body to translate nutrients and other products that keep us living. In the setting of a more advanced cancer, the body loses its ability to maintain itself.
There is, of course, a very prominent survivor, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You know, I'm not sure how much you know about her treatment, but what made her cancer less deadly than others?
Well, we don't know. I mean, you know, she was treated with an operation first and then received, to the best of my knowledge, then received chemotherapy afterwards. And in fact, now the trend throughout the entire United States is towards reversing the order of treatments in people with operable cancer. But she had a relatively small tumor in the pancreas that was surgically excised. And now in retrospect, we can say that she didn't have, the cancer had not spread to any other part of her body. And, you know, the whole biology behind why and how cancer spreads to other parts of the body is just fascinating, because clearly each different type of cancer has its own predilection to spread to certain areas in the body. So, for example, pancreas cancer most frequently spreads to the liver, occasionally the lining of the tummy, and occasionally the lung. Almost never goes to the brain, very rarely goes to the bone. Patients rarely develop nodules in their skin, as opposed to melanoma, which can spread to other parts of the skin very commonly. Breast cancer can obviously spread to the brain, similar to kidney cancer. So you can see it's fascinating how there is, if you will, a seed and soil hypothesis behind why certain tumors may spread to other parts of the body. And then secondly, why in some patients the tumor cells are unsuccessful in setting up a home in, for example, the liver. If we take pancreas cancer, Judge Ginsburg, obviously her pancreas tumor, even though it had access to the bloodstream probably a year or two or 3 years prior to her diagnosis, those circulating tumor cells never implanted in her liver or in her lung. Therefore, when her tumor was removed, she was, if you will, cured. And why she was cured and someone else with an exactly identical CT scan is not cured is really a mystery that we haven't yet, as of now, solved. We do believe, however, that for those patients who have a small amount of cancer, so microscopic cancer that really can't be detected in other parts of the body at the time they're diagnosed, they may actually be cured with a change in the paradigm of how we treat them. And that's why currently in 2019, we typically begin first with chemotherapy, then we add in some radiation, and we have a few really neat and exciting innovative clinical trials here at the Medical College of Wisconsin that capitalize on all of this. And then after the radiation, then consider surgery. So kind of the opposite treatment that Judge Ginsburg received.
Well, and so much has changed in the last 20 years since she was first diagnosed. What do you see as the most exciting things that are currently happening in pancreatic cancer care? And what do you see as the future of this type of care?
Sure. Approximately a year and a half ago, we closed the first clinical trial of personalized medicine performed anywhere in the world for patients with operable pancreas cancer. And that clinical trial has now been published. And that was the first trial in the world which biopsied the tumors. And then the genetic profile of those tumor cells was then developed. And based upon that genetic profile, we could infer whether certain chemotherapy drugs would be effective or ineffective against that patient's tumor. And so each patient received somewhat of a unique, personalized, and slightly different treatment with the idea that that treatment would be more effective. Sure enough, that actually came to be true when we analyzed the results of 130 patients that were treated here with chemotherapy, selected specifically for them based on the molecular profile of their tumor, followed by radiation therapy, and then their tumor was surgically excised. The tumor was then reprofiled at a genetic level, and in some patients, they received additional chemotherapy after that. So building on that clinical trial, what we're doing now is we're saying, you know, we really need to find out much more quickly whether the treatment is effective or ineffective. I think there are probably some people listening who have a relative or a friend or perhaps even themselves who received chemotherapy or some treatment for a cancer of some kind, and the treatment proved to be ineffective.
Well, and to just take a step back, I think a lot of people are unclear that chemotherapy isn't a one-size-fit-all kind of drug, that there are, in fact, many different kinds of chemotherapy.
Absolutely, and they're specific for the organ where the tumor arose from, and they're also specific for the genetic mutational spectrum that the tumor may have. So we're now realizing even that that treating patients based upon where the cancer arose from, lung, breast, pancreas, liver, may actually not be as important as the genetic underpinning of the tumor itself. And that's a whole nother area of research. What we're doing in our current clinical trial is we're just taking that simple clinical observation that many of the listeners have appreciated, that sometimes the treatment works and sometimes it doesn't work. And we're saying, well, can we make that decision really early? After just 6-8 weeks of treatment, can we make the determination as to whether this treatment is the best it can be for this patient based upon a variety of parameters, CT scans, blood tests, various other measurements? And then if it's working very well and the cancer is regressing, continue it. But if things aren't better, they can't just be stable, they have to be better, then we change treatments. So I think really a much more active, dynamic way to treat pancreas cancer than has ever been done before.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Evans, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with us.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Douglas Evans is the chair of the Department of Surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he's an expert on pancreatic cancer. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Coming up next, our Fit for You segment explores a new facility specifically built for our aging population. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, all baby boomers will be over the age of 65 by 2030. That means one in five residents will be of retirement age. And that means more people will be living with chronic conditions and general age-related issues, even as their life expectancy increases. Here in Wisconsin, Waukesha County is home to the state's largest senior population. Active and aging adults and their families have always been at the heart of the YMCA. However, not many gyms or health facilities are tailored for just aging adults. While the YMCA of Greater Waukesha is making strides to change that, the new Berlin YMCA Wellness Center just opened this past week. It's a custom-designed facility for active and aging adults designed to make them feel welcome and at ease, whether they're looking to maintain their fitness or looking to reclaim their health. For this month's Fit for You, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski visited the new Wellness Center, and she was joined by Workplace Wellness Director of the YMCA of Greater Waukesha County, Anna Schmidt, and Hannah Miziak, the Y's Healthy Living Director. Schmidt begins by explaining why the YMCA decided to take the initiative and dedicate a center for aging adults.
Thank you both so much for joining me today, and thanks for having me at this new facility.
Well, thank you so much. We're happy to have you here.
So this YMCA is specifically geared toward aging adults. So to your knowledge, is this one of the first in Wisconsin, or is this a recent development in the health and wellness world where we now need specific places for certain populations?
Yes, absolutely. We know that our population is aging, and especially here in New Berlin, where this center is located, we know that there's a need for this, and we have an aging population, and so we're here to serve that need. And we are one of the first in the nation to have a facility dedicated towards this population.
So when you think of a facility dedicated to an aging population, what comes to mind and what were the requirements and the things you needed to meet outside of the commonplace, say, ADA requirements of physically building a space? But what did you have in mind that it needed to encompass overall?
I think we're really thinking about the community in general and creating community within our center. So coming together, building social connection between the members. Everything from how they're being greeted by our staff to how they're moving through a facility in a tour, what we're focusing on with our equipment, focusing on accessibility and different populations to bridge the gap between healthcare and community health and fitness.
So as our population overall, it's getting older, people are living longer, it's getting bigger. So is there a different definition of, quote, aging adult now?
Well, I mean, I think we're all aging, so we really want to make sure that this facility is open not only to the older adult population, but also those who might be experiencing some health conditions or chronic disease. So, you know, again, we're all aging, but we want to make sure that we have programs available that can support anyone to reclaim their health.
You mentioned some of those challenges of reclaiming health. So what other challenges are we facing as people are living longer that places like the Y are keeping in mind to have an even longer plan?
We are really looking at the continuum of care. So we know that healthcare serves a purpose, and we know that people are coming back from chronic disease conditions and living longer with those chronic disease states. So we want to make sure that they're living their best lives and able to see them through that recovery process or even living through those diseases.
And are you bringing on any more specialized staff for those types of care? Because typically the Y, we see that as a gym, health and wellness place. You have personal trainers, physical trainers, but are there any additional medical trainers, medical support that is incorporated into this facility?
We do have specific equipment that is medical grade that will be helpful for those maybe who have some of those conditions. We also have a very specialized program for chronic disease that we'll be able to offer at this facility to really help individuals reclaim their health and get on a path to better health and wellness. We're also looking to partner with the healthcare community so that we can make sure that we're providing the adequate staff and making sure that everyone is within their scope of practice that we can provide the best care that we can here.
So this perhaps isn't the first time you maybe have heard this of the Y, but the Y, I think, traditionally had that reputation of being an old person's gym. You know, that's where people are going for senior swim, wherever else, and then it's kind of shifted back to reclaiming the whole scope of our population. And then this facility in particular is shifting now to aging adults. So what do you think the Y's image has been or always has been, or what are you trying to change about it?
We've always been open to all. We don't want to exclude anyone regardless of their age, their background. We are definitely known as a family facility. If you look at our other locations, we have a ton of family programming, but we also serve kids that are as young as 6 weeks old to people who are in their hundreds. So we do want to be available to all. With this building specifically, we will be focusing on the adult population. We're not going to have some of our typical services here like our pool, our youth programming, but as a YMCA, we're still committed to being available to all members of our community.
Why was that important to make programs specifically for aging adults? I know the latest fitness trends is studios, is specific programs. You have CrossFit, Orange Theory, that kind of thing. High intensity interval training, you know, things that not everybody can accomplish right away, or maybe they're not comfortable walking in and learning to modify things if they see people around them going to this level. So how were you aware of and conscious of making this facility what it needed to be for this population?
I think we really looked at the community need, and as a nonprofit organization, the Y has always kind of looked into our own community where we're serving to meet the needs of that particular community. And when we look at the community data from New Berlin, we see that aging population and we see the need to step in and be that place for those residents.
Now, what kind of equipment programs and services are here specifically for aging adults that makes this wellness center unique?
So I can speak a little bit to the equipment that we have here. So we have a number of new step trainers, which are a recumbent cross trainer. And this is particularly important for those that have mobility challenges. You'll see these a lot being used post-rehabilitation, after joint replacement, surgery, cardiac events, stroke. It does simulate the motions of walking, and they are very accessible. The chair swivels all the way around, so it's easy to get in and out. It's appropriate for a wide variety of people. Some of our other equipment that we have reflex treadmills that have a special cushioning component to them, so you reduce the impact on joints. We have incline trainers for those that want a little bit more challenge through walking or running, but particularly in walking to just change the grade and the elevation rather than the speed. So it's a different way to get a more intense workout. We also have some medical grade cardio equipment. So we have our Cyfit medical grade treadmill. One of the cool features about that one is that you can actually make the belt go in reverse, so you can do backwards walking. That's something that we see a lot when we're working with Parkinson's patients that we want to have them do. That one you can change the grade on as well. And it has handrails that extend all the way back for accessibility getting on and off. We have a Cyfit recumbent stepper that really encourages our activities of daily life, and it has a very low starting resistance level. We have our Cyfit total body exerciser, which includes an arm ergometer for those that are coming back post shoulder surgery or really working to build strength in one of their limbs. It also has pedals on the bottom as well. So it has both upper and lower cranks, and those are fully accessible. The chair actually slides all the way off. So for those that are in a wheelchair, they can use that equipment. And we have a Cyfit elliptical as well, which is a medical grade device, and that is a rear entry elliptical trainer for those that can't sidestep onto the elliptical. It also has handrails for ease of getting on and off, and it has a BioFlex footbed, which actually moves with your foot to help with stability. And then we have our free motion new Epix electrolyzed weight equipment, and we're one of the first ones to have that weight equipment. And that really focuses on unilateral movements. So rather than the traditional fixed positioning where you're pushing it and both arms are moving, these one arm can move independently from the other, so we can really work on muscular imbalances with those. And it does mimic more of a natural movement pattern.
These equipment pieces you've been listing, they all seem great. There's good accessibility to them, good stability factors. What also comes to my mind is a price, right? Because these are not typical treadmills, ellipticals that you're going to find in your normal gyms that perhaps a bigger company can say, like, okay, we have a budget for this, this, and this. So was it a difficult case at all to research these different pieces of equipment and to find what was right and to say, like, hey, I know this may be a stark difference between what's here, but what makes that worth it for the why to invest in things like this?
I think that if we're going to do a facility like the one that we are creating, we want to make sure that we're doing it correctly and have the appropriate equipment for the populations that we're looking to serve. And especially as we're looking to partner with healthcare organizations, we want to make sure that we're equipped with the proper equipment.
I see good potential in this facility to go beyond people's physical therapy or occupational therapy, because a lot of times people, they come from an injury, a surgery, they're only approved for, say, 2 weeks of something, but then they're sent on their way, you're doing good enough, you know, it's kind of that teetering seesaw. It's like, you can't be doing too well because you might need some more physical therapy or you'd be comfortable having more sessions. But what kind of role can this YMCA play when people are looking for that extra help, that extra stability, that extra training that they feel they might need after they've been approved for X amount of time through insurance?
Yep, so we certainly are not medical experts here at the Y. We kind of know our role, and we do have fitness expertise here, and we are hoping that we can serve as kind of that continuum of care where after people, you know, no longer have their sessions within their healthcare facility, they can come to the Y, especially here where it's a little bit smaller scale. We have the specialized equipment, and we have the proper staff who are trained to be able to support these members. You know, we're really hoping to create a formalized referral process so that the healthcare community can direct them to here and feel that they're in a safe space where they can achieve some of their goals. Belonging to the Y2 will allow them to be here as long as they like. You know, we're not going to, they don't only have so many sessions. They can join our facility and become a member of this community and also, you know, develop some of those personal relationships with other members here as well.
That personal relationship aspect is really important to not just accountability for people's health, but their mental health too. And solitude in the aging population is a big problem. So how do you plan to care for your members in this facility, even if they're outside the doors?
We did intentionally create a very welcoming member lounge here at this facility with the hope to kind of cultivate those relationships. You know, even we see at our other YMCAs that they come for their fitness class, but then afterwards they stick around in our lobby and have coffee for, you know, as long as they want. We're not going to kick them out. We hope to do that here as well and create that welcoming environment. We also have plans to make sure that we have some social events that we can invite our members and hopefully our community members as well to help create that sense of belonging and maybe help with some of the social isolation that they experience.
Now, one thing that's unique here is the Healthy Living Hub and things like a teaching kitchen. And often when it comes with aging, there's less drive, less motivation to cook for yourself, to shop. You know, that's another big important aspect to health is what we're putting in our bodies, not just exercising. So how are programs like these going to help facilitate a bigger picture of wellness for our aging population?
So like you mentioned, it's more than just your physical health, and that extends far beyond fitness. We will have our teaching kitchen here. Our hope for that is that we're really helping people learn how it can be easy and it can be low cost to make these healthy meals at home. We have hired specific staff to run these cooking demos that we'll have here with the intent that they're going to be making meals that people will be able to try while they're here, and then with the hopes that they're going to try them at home. We're not going to try to do any fancy Iron Chef thing here. We really want people to be able to translate that into their home, make it fun, make it taste good. But yes, the nutrition is so important too. As the population ages, it's just as important as the fitness.
What are some physical baselines Or are you guys creating any physical baselines that new members can have a goal to attain to? Or are you mainly looking for individualized care when people come through the door?
Yeah, we're definitely not one size fits all, and we're completely dedicated to the individual's experiences they're coming in those doors. So even through our intake process and tour process, we'll be asking people what their goals are, why are they coming here, and what do they need to get out of us, and what are they hoping to get out of being a member here. And our goal is then to help them find a path towards whichever goal they choose. So we are completely dedicated towards the individualized experience.
So this being a new facility, it's still, you know, getting the final touches as we're speaking here. How are you planning to foster the growth with the aging population to let them know we're here, this is what's different about us, and this is where you can find a long-term home?
We're lucky to be located in New Berlin. Right next door, we actually do have a senior living facility. Our hope is to try to connect with those different facilities within this area, make sure that they know we are available. A lot of our memberships are insurance eligible memberships, so some of the aging population might actually have this benefit included as part of their insurance. So we want to make sure that we get out into the community and share that information. We'll also be doing some, you know, targeted marketing with some print materials as well to make sure that people know we're here. But I think what will be really important is that we're getting out into the community and going to have those conversations with the larger organizations and also the healthcare organizations within our service area as well.
So this is kind of the first steps, you know, for this facility, for the why. What are you two looking forward to the most?
I am especially excited about our teaching kitchen. I'm the Healthy Living Director for our association. We've been trying to integrate nutrition into more of what we do at the Y. We're typically known as a fitness facility, although we do much more than fitness. Having the teaching kitchen available here will allow us to do so much more and actually show people rather than just tell them what it means to be healthy. And hopefully then they can learn and take those skills and apply it versus just, you know, hearing about it at our other facilities. So I'm especially excited about that.
I'm excited that we've done healthy living, I think, well at all of our Ys, but to have this really be the heart and center of healthy living, to have all of our healthy living programs here, from our diabetes prevention program to our Live Strong at the YMCA program, having the cooking demos, starting to integrate more of our Moving for Better Balance as we look into new programming that we're bringing on, and really being that answer to what's next after healthcare or rehab or whatever that might be for the person, or just looking to reclaim their health or be a healthier person. I think we're really serving a unique need here, and I'm excited to see how that unfolds.
Anna Schmidt is the Workplace Wellness Director of the YMCA of Greater Waukesha County, and Hannah Miziak is its Healthy Living Director. They spoke on location at the New Berlin YMCA Wellness Center with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for this month's Fit for You segment. You can explore past segments and see photos of this facility at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then local novelist Nick Petrie joins us to talk about the latest in his Peter Ash series. Lake Effect returns with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Whitefish Bay author Nick Petrie has been a frequent guest on the show. We've talked with him over the years about the first three installments in his series of novels that feature ex-Marine combat veteran and Milwaukeean Peter Ash. And this past January was no different. Book number 4, Tear It Down, was published to great fanfare and a book launch at Boswell Book Company. Before that launch, Nick joined me in the studio to talk about life, the universe, and everything. And I asked him whether he ever expected or imagined that we'd be talking about book number 4.
Well, hello, Nick. It is January. It is, and you know what that means.
There's a new book.
It means I get to be back here talking with you, Bonnie.
Yes, it does. And I'm so excited. Well, we're going to get to talk on Monday at Boswell Books together. But this is a little bit of a preview for that and maybe to get folks to come out and hear us live. We are so much better live.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course. We're certainly better looking live than
Absolutely.
We are on the radio.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of us are. So this is number four. Number four, did you ever think?
No, never. I never thought the first book would see the light of day. And here I am. The fourth book is going to be out any minute. I'm revising the fifth book. I've got plans for six and seven. Life is strange and wonderful.
As we get to know our hero, because he is, and this is one of the things we have talked about over the years for every book, he is complex. He's not black and white. He's not easy. He's not pigeonholed or easily pigeonholed. But as we get to know him more and more, and in this book particularly, we get to know him in a different way, I think. I mean, was that intentional for you? I mean, we know about the PTSD, but he's working on some interesting pieces of that.
Well, the goal is with every book to kind of move him a little farther down his timeline. And when I started all of this, I don't think I really knew enough about post-traumatic stress and what a big deal it is for many people. And so I sort of thought, well, I'll write one book about a guy with post-traumatic stress and then it'll get better and it'll be about something else. But the more I learned and the more people I talked to, the more clear it is that for some people, this is something that really lasts in some way or another through their whole life. And so I wanted to kind of chart the path of him working through these issues of what it's like to have been to war, to have been in combat, you know, for an extensive period of time, which really messes with you. And some people can do it with no problem at all. But for most people, there is a period where you really have to reckon with it. And that was sort of my goal, was to sort of show that evolution through time. But also, every book can't be about this particular issue. And so I wanted him to sort of be out in the rest of the world a little bit and to use some of those same – to see how some of those same issues really – are experienced by people in other worlds. There's a great piece on Chicago Public Radio a couple years ago about how young people who live in areas where gangs are prevalent show all the symptoms of post-traumatic stress. So if you're a 17-year-old high school kid and you are trying to avoid that life, you know, you see, you know, you're in that kind of neighborhood, you get shot at, your friends die. I have friends who've been through that. So I wanted to kind of show that aspect of it. And I have a character named Wanda Wyatt who's a war correspondent. She's a combat photographer because I've talked to people who have been journalists in war zones and what's that like and what effects do that have. So I wanted to sort of see what the other ramifications of that would be for other people in those kinds of situations.
Well, and putting them all together in this one story is interesting because you get to see those different threads, and you have a teenager who is a musical phenom, but who's in the middle of a very, very ugly situation in his hometown of Memphis, which is where the most of this book takes place.
Right. Well, and one of the challenges I set for myself for this book was that I wanted to tell these two sort of parallel storylines. So we have this this young guy, this 15-year-old kid named Eli Bell, who's a musician, who is trying to keep himself out of sort of the gangster life in Memphis, in a place where there really aren't other paths. There aren't that many other choices. But as often happens, his friends kind of rope him into something. And so I wanted to tell Eli's story as well as kind of what's happening with Wanda Wyatt, this combat photographer, and with Peter being sort of the link between the two, Peter Ash, my hero. And I'd never really told this sort of braided sort of series of stories before. And so that was kind of the thing I was trying to set for myself. And it was weird. It was a very different thing to do. But that's part of, you know, the goal is to keep trying to do something different, to not just tell the same story over again.
One of the things that I noticed about Peter in this book is talking about the PTSD is that there are moments in here where he's reconciling with it in a way where he realizes that he enjoys it. There's parts of it that he really likes, and he wants that feeling of that adrenaline and the feeling of rising to that occasion. And we've seen that in him before in the other books, but it's like he has a self-awareness, I think, in this book that maybe he's earned over time. Maybe he's earned it because he's spent time with June, who's not really – she's there but not really in this book a lot.
No, there's a bit less of her in this book. And that's deliberate, is because, the goal wasn't to have every book be sort of how they are together and how their relationship is evolving forward. It's to sort of allow that to unfold a little bit from book to book. But, you know, that's really the dirty secret of war, is that it's exciting. And that's how we get young men to go risk their lives, is that there is this sort of adrenaline component to it, and along with this intense camaraderie that comes from being this close-knit group of people going through, this incredible crucible of experience. And, you know, there are veterans who one of the components to the challenge of coming home from a war zone is that they miss that. They miss the camaraderie and that feeling of connection, which is really hard to obtain any other way.
Well, particularly for men in our society, you're not supposed to have those kinds of close bonds with other men.
Right, and men often don't really learn how to build those friendships. Whereas I think for women, it's one of the things that you learn in your childhood. And you know, for men, it's, you know, in our culture at least, it's really about being stoic and being strong and, you know, suck it up and go to work and all that stuff. But those relationships, I mean, that's one of the things I'm really trying to convey, is the intensity and the pleasure of those relationships. But it's also part of what makes it hard to go back to, you know, the so-called normal world, is how do you create something that is hopefully less lethal but still as rich and invigorating as, you know, this terrible combat experience.
Well, you mentioned Wanda, the combat photographer, and the reason Peter is in Memphis is because of her and because June sent him there. And you've managed somehow to talk about tying things together in interesting ways. You know, she's in a house that people are sort of blowing up or trying to.
Well, and that's what kicks this whole thing into gear is Peter, my protagonist, is, kind of restless at home, and he's trying to find an excuse to go have another adventure and to kind of scratch his adrenaline itch. And June sort of sees this in him and says, well, I have a friend in Memphis who's being harassed. And by the time he gets there, somebody's actually driven a dump truck into her living room. So Peter's job is to find out kind of who's harassing her and why and all of the, you know, that's one of the threads that starts to unravel.
And of course, one of my favorite characters makes a return visit, and that is Lewis. I think everyone loves Lewis. There's just something about Lewis.
People do love Lewis.
I want him to be my friend. I really do.
Well, and there's something about Lewis in that Lewis doesn't particularly care what anybody thinks. Lewis has his own path that he's traveling, and he plays by his own set of rules. And there's something that is, I think, really appealing to those of us who, you know, set the alarm clock every morning and we go off to work and we do the dishes and we go to the grocery store and all those things. He is just a blast to write because I get to indulge that part of myself that wants none of those things.
But Lewis has those things. He just goes away from it a lot.
Right, right. Well, my line is that he's a semi-reformed career criminal, or he likes to think he's reformed, except, you know, like Peter, he sort of misses the action. So he's looking for any excuse to go play.
Well, and he and Peter have such a wonderful connection too. And we see it in different ways. I mean, of course, they have each other's backs and all of that. But I remember as I was reading this book thinking, oh, we're talking about some interesting stuff here that they haven't really talked about before. They've kind of touched, and we're talking about race, we're talking about friendship, what that means, friendship between men, friendship between men of two different races. And there's just some interesting stuff that kind of has come out in this book that I hope you're going to continue with.
Well, I've always seemed to find myself writing about both something that's sort of happening in my own life and something that I'm observing in the culture and something I'm interested in. So when the Drifter, my first book, is really about veterans coming home and was also about sort of the aftermath of the financial crisis. Both two things that I really couldn't stop thinking about. The next book, Burning Bright, is really about emerging technology. It takes place on the West Coast, and I read a lot of science fiction growing up, and so it was a chance to play with some of that kind of stuff. But I think those are real issues too, in that, you know, the world is changing quickly, and we are not being very deliberate about our choices, about what we're choosing to adopt and what we're not choosing to adopt. You look at social media, you know, all of those things. The third book was about was set in Colorado, and it's about the newly legal cannabis industry, and you know, so what are the ramifications of that? And this book, I didn't really set out to write about, you know, race and class and friendship, but when you set a book in Memphis, and music is a part of it, it's almost inevitable, especially kind of the way that my work sort of shows up. So I'm not sure I could avoid it. The funny thing about this book is there is no earthquake in it, but I picked Memphis in part because it's the center of something called the New Madrid Seismic Zone. We think about earthquakes in the West Coast, but this is the site of four of the largest earthquakes in recorded American history in the early 1800s. And they think that there's another one that's, you know, kind of due any minute. And I had this sort of elaborate plan with this earthquake and all these different groups of people were going to come together. And of course, you know, my plans always sort of get turned on their head and the earthquake never shows up. And I'm writing about, you know, these people and their relationships, which is what interests me.
Without giving anything away, I have to say that final chapter is quite breathtaking.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you. That's the goal. I see how long you can hold your breath.
Yeah. It was like, wow. That must have been fun to write.
It was fun to write. It's an interesting process to I don't outline. I sort of write forward, and sometimes that means I have to write backwards because I it goes a direction that it turns out it shouldn't really go, or I have to go back and revise something to make it all fit in. But to discover as I write, to have this an incident kind of emerge out of midair, and I don't want to spoil this for anybody who has not read this book, and I don't think anybody who's listening to this has really read this book because it's not out yet. But my last book, there's a gurney ride down a mountain road.
Yeah, I remember that.
That I didn't plan. It just sort of came about in the through the course of the story, and people kept talking about it. People talk about it to me. I had a conversation about it 3 days ago, and it's not something I planned. I could never. What a ridiculous thing to put in the story. But it sort of arose naturally. And I think it's believable because it arose naturally. And that's part of the fun is to sort of, you know, to be lying in bed in the middle of the night and have this idea just pop into my head.
And you go, ooh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see where that one goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you think people in Memphis are going to react to how you drew their city, how you created their city?
I don't know. You know, I'm always a little concerned about that. And this is the first book I've written about a place where I never really had a personal connection, right? So I wrote a book about Milwaukee, which is easy because I grew up in Milwaukee. I live here now. I wrote a book about the West Coast. I've traveled all over the West Coast. I lived in Seattle for 10 years. I wrote a book about Denver and Colorado, and I've traveled through Colorado, and I have friends there. But, you know, I'd never been to Memphis. I wrote half the book before I went there. But I had spent time in Detroit, and there are some similarities. They actually have a lot of similarities to Milwaukee on a certain level, where we have our deeply challenged urban core, where most of the work and most of the money is outside the city proper. So that was kind of my access point. But you know, I try very hard to keep the setting real. You know, if I'm describing a patch of woods in the middle of a bad part of town, that patch of woods is really there. If I'm describing a building, there's a juke joint in this book. It's based on a real juke joint. I mean, I've spent time in Memphis, so I spent a lot of time and effort on that because I don't want people to feel like I'm just, you know, using and abusing their town. I want to make it feel lived in, and I'm also really interested in setting. And the wonderful thing about this character, who is really kind of rootless, is that I can really set a book in the place that suits the story best. And in a way, the story that I'm telling comes out of the place that it's in. This book, Tear It Down, set in Memphis, would have been a different book if I'd set it in Austin or I'd set it in Atlanta.
Or Detroit.
So that's part of the fun, is sort of finding what that setting wants to tell me. So what's the story that's going to come out of that particular place?
Very cool. That's a great way to think about it.
It's a weird process. Writers are very strange people.
Well, that's all right. We still like having them into Lake Effect anyway. So, well, Nick Petrie, thanks so much. Best of luck on your tour, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Nick Petrie's latest novel, the fourth in his Peter Ash series, is called Tear It Down. Our interview with him first aired in January. And that wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.